Welcome to Off Message. I'm Tim Alberta.
Over $200 million this cycle, and I think we really surprised the other side.
They're not used to being outspent.
They're not used to being outspent, and we laid in wait until Labor Day. You sort of picture that, what is it, in Braveheart or whatever, hold, and then boom, come Labor Day, the last 9 weeks, we let them have it. We outspent the other side in 90% of the districts, the competitive districts, the last 9 weeks.
Does that make you William Wallace? Hey, thanks for waiting the extra day and joining us on this special post-election edition of Off Message. Tuesday's results demonstrated the degree to which the country is fracturing, politically, culturally, and otherwise, with exurban and rural areas getting more and more conservative and suburban areas getting more and more liberal. This manifested itself in the sharply diverging results in the House and Senate elections. In the lower chamber, Democrats stormed back into the majority, capturing what should be, when all of the votes in California are finally counted, a net gain of 34 to 36 seats. The Senate map was an entirely different story. Republicans picked up at least 3 seats and have expanded their majority heading into the final 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. We wanted to focus this special edition of Off Message on the battle for the House, which gained most of the nation's attention and certainly drew the lion's share of the outside money from Republican and Democratic-affiliated organizations. The two biggest organizations fighting for control of the House were the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is allied with Speaker Paul Ryan and the House Republican leadership, and on the other side, House Majority PAC, the principal organization allied with House Democrats in their fight to retake control of the chamber. As we began to sift through the results of Tuesday and consider the implications for the next 2 years and beyond, I had the opportunity to sit down with the two men running those respective organizations, Corey Bliss, the executive director of the Congressional Leadership Fund, and Charlie Kelly, the executive director of House Majority PAC. To the victor goes the spoils, and in this case, that means we talk to Charlie first. Charlie, thanks so much for being with us. Obviously, a lot to digest from last night, and I want to start here. I think, big picture, people aren't surprised that, you know, Democrats are going to wind up picking up seats somewhere in the mid-30s when all the dust settles here. But I'm wondering for you, as you're watching the returns come in, you're so invested in many of these races, what the biggest surprises were for you, and start on the plus side. What was the most pleasant surprise for you, a race that you weren't necessarily expecting to win, but when it came on the board for you, you were thrilled?
Yeah. So, I think by and large, the takeaway for me is that we were able to be competitive in a bunch of places. Both the sort of, we identified, I think, very early sort of the scattered partisanship post 2016. So things were not necessarily sort of dialed in based on historical performance in these races. I think you sort of had to throw that aside based on what happened in the 2016 race. And we looked at things very much in sort of different order. College opposite non-college, these suburban districts, highly educated, higher median income, higher education or information, opposite some of the more working class districts, and the sort of parallel track strategy that we ran kind of, you know, in both of those places. What I was encouraged about is the fact that we were able to be competitive in both of those types of districts. And upstate New York, I was watching very, very closely, super encouraged by Anthony Brindisi in New York 22. That's one of the places where we invested starting in April, frankly, on our paid media efforts. And over the course of the summer, ran a digital program there. And then obviously in the fall, right around Labor Day and on, we were on TV almost throughout.
And that's a district where Trump has been pretty popular.
Well, and he is. And the data that we saw throughout, he was probably a plus 10 or 12 job performance. The generic was not in our favor there. I think people, like, if they were to say, well, yeah, the generic's in your favor everywhere, it was not in upstate New York, certainly in central New York. And he overperformed. And I think that the contrast that we outlined early on to help disqualify Tenney was, you know, really, really important. Healthcare oriented, you know, increase in premiums, the age tax, the fact that the tax plan increased the debt and then to pay for it, cutting Medicare and Social Security, powerful arguments, things that we've seen nationally. But those were focused there. Maine too is what I'm encouraged about. I think at the end of the day, that Jared Golden will be successful. I think he's down within, I heard, 17 votes at one point today.
It's going to be a heck of a recount.
It's a heck of a recount. But with ranked choice voting, really, if you weren't with the incumbent, with Poliquin to start, there's not really that opportunity. I don't think the folks that voted for Tiffany Bond or Will Hoare are going to be with Poliquin at the end of the day. And so they go through the ranked choice voting process, which I sort of marginally understand, but I do think that
we're all getting there.
I think Jared Golden's going to be in good shape. The suburban districts played out the way I thought they would, which is encouraging. Our data, I think, was, you know, I give a lot of credit to the data folks that we worked with at Civis, and the polling that we did throughout IVR surveys, sort of shorter snapshot surveys, feeding them into our forecasting tools. We always saw Minnesota 3 in good shape, but encouraged to see that that played out the way we thought. Colorado 6, another one, Kansas 3, we always saw in pretty good shape, and so glad to see those. The New Jersey races largely, and I think New Jersey 7 and 11 looked good for us heading into Election Day, and we felt good about that. New Jersey 3 is one on the margin, and I think we invested over $3 million there. Remains to be seen what happens. Andy Kim and Tom MacArthur, I do think there's 19,000 absentee ballots outstanding, a number of thousands of provisional ballots, because a lot of folks, based on the new law and the fact that you receive mail ballots there, or absentees, a lot of people, I think, discarded them, but they went and had to vote provisionally. I think a lot of those votes will be counted, so I feel good about that. Curbelo was a surprise. Not a surprise. We saw the trend line upwards towards the end, but winning two seats out of Miami-Dade, I think, is extraordinary. Lauren Underwood was excellent. We invested there early in the sort of exurbs of Chicago. I guess the true surprises were South Carolina 1 and Oklahoma 5, but here's what I'll say about those two. Heading into Election Day, South Carolina 1, we actually had survey data that had down a couple. One of our partner groups, 314 Action, was big in that race, and they'd done a lot of sort of paid media work. We saw that two-thirds of the AFAM voters were undecided at that point. We felt if they broke the way we expected them to break, that we could actually potentially pick up that race. And that's one maybe where it's just sort of like let it lie in wait and see what happens.
Don't draw too much attention to it.
Exactly. And then Oklahoma 5, the Bloomberg folks were on the case there, getting a call from them. And that one obviously played out, you know, how they sort of said, look, we'll take a flyer here, see what the reality is. And obviously it played out extraordinary.
So Charlie, what about the unpleasant surprises? Give me a couple of races where, you know, this time yesterday you were really feeling optimistic about, and they just didn't quite get across the finish line.
Yeah. I mean, I think Kansas too. I think Paul Davis is an exceptional public servant. I think he's in it for the right reasons. I mean, look, we're watching these races from afar. But serving in the state legislature, obviously he ran for governor. He's a terrific guy. I thought that he would sneak that one out. Watkins has proven to be a fraud in sort of every way. Our survey work suggested that Paul Davis was ahead marginally, you know, within the margin of error. But I thought he would sneak it out. That one right now is a disappointment, and one I expected Paul Davis to come to Congress. So, you know, that's a tough one. Minnesota 1, Dan Feehan. You know, I'm from Minnesota. I thought that we potentially would hold that wall seat. I think some of the doom and gloom stuff at the end of the cycle that the Republicans sort of relied on kind of snuck up and caught Feehan. And I think that, look, that one's still there's still potential there, and there's a recount. But at this point, you know, that one looks tough.
You know, it's interesting you make that point about the doom and gloom. And I've had this conversation with some smart people in the last 24 hours, because look, for all the talk of the scattershot messaging from Republicans down the stretch, and how tax reform really never wound up being the rhetorical cornerstone, or the intellectual cornerstone, or however you want to think about it, of the Republican campaign this year, there's an argument to be made that in a number of these districts, Republicans probably benefited from the Trump cultural driven issues being front and center, rather than tax reform being front and center.
So I think I would like to say, I mean, the thing that I was really encouraged about throughout the cycle, one, starts with the candidates on the Dem side. We've never seen candidates of this, like, sort of these well-credentialed candidates, extraordinary track records of success in their professional fields, diverse professional fields. We're going to have 100 women or more in Congress after last night.
It's a record.
It's a record. Number two, the grassroots, the sort of surge in enthusiasm that really powered not only the boots on the ground, the sort of organic effort through groups like Indivisible, sort of new efforts on the ground, focused on House races, doing the great work, not only the boots on the ground work, but also sort of powering these campaigns, allowing us to outspend our opposition down the stretch. The consistency in the message work is number three, because look, number one is the candidates, two is the grassroots. They set the table for us to be successful on the IE front. But I think our discipline and message, our perspective on focusing on the sort of disastrous healthcare plan, the increase in premiums, the tax scam, and the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, 90% of the benefits to the top 1% or the wealthiest Americans, increase the debt $1.9 trillion to pay for it. You're going to cut Social Security and Medicare. any marginal gain anyone would feel is wiped out because it's going to elevate or increase premiums $1,500 a year. Those focused message items, to me, drove the day. There are a couple of places, yes, where they potentially had some success at the end, maybe. But for us to be competitive in New York 22 and New York 19 and Maine 2 and Iowa 1 and Iowa 3, all seats that we look to win, Illinois 6, Illinois 14, the Virginia races, Virginia 7, Virginia 2, to me, the list goes on and on. And I think at the end of the day, the contrast on the economic or kitchen table issues
the
led the way.
Pocketbook issue, sure. Yeah, and Charlie, look, you were just talking about something really important, which is the quality of the Democratic recruits, not just in the abstract, but specific to their districts, people who fit their districts. I was struck over the weekend, the last weekend before the election, I swung through the Midwest and spent some time with a number of Democratic challengers there, Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan 8, Dean Phillips in Minnesota 3. These are people who were really going out of their way throughout the campaign to triangulate against what, you know, could be perceived as a Democratic Party nationally and a Democratic grassroots nationally. They're so fired up by Trump that maybe the party's moving too far left. And they were very intentional in these districts that have been historically held by Republicans to present themselves as, you know, not partisan firebrands, but as pragmatic, effective, thoughtful lawmakers who want to come to Congress for the right reasons, not just to try and burn the place down and go after Trump, but to try and get things done. Can you talk to me about how difficult it is in an environment like this for those candidates to thread that needle?
Well, but I think that was the message from the top. I mean, these are common sense leaders in their communities who want to get things done. And I think whether it's in Michigan, Alyssa Slotkin, or Haley Stevens, whether you're talking about upstate New York, across the Midwest, even out to California. I mean, these folks have had success in their professional fields and a diverse array of professional fields. And heading to Congress, what they want to do is they want to pursue an agenda that works to lift up the middle class. That's the unifier. That's when we've had the most success as a Democratic Party. The hallmark for us is, what are we doing for working families? And these folks, that was the unifying message throughout. I think it's the thread, frankly, across all these Democratic candidates. And when we focused on the economic message, that's why we had success. The Trump stuff is baked in. We know that. Our research suggests it. We know it. The chaos, the noise in Washington, you know, people are used to it for whatever reason. But beyond that, it's, what are you doing for me? That's what folks are saying in these communities. The Democratic candidates spoke to that specifically. And a lot of the noise from the Republican side, a lot of the doom and gloom stuff, I think fell flat. They pursued what I would say, again, is a scattershot message strategy. They said they're going to run on taxes. They didn't. They moved on in Connor Lamb's race quickly to immigration. Then they moved on to him being weak on crime, et cetera, et cetera. It all didn't work. It played out in other races as well. And we saw that. They had a kill him in the cradle strategy at the beginning of August that largely fell flat. For the couple of races, it may have had marginal success. Those were sort of self-inflicted wounds that the Democrats had.
Talking about like Kentucky 6, for example.
And maybe Ohio 1. The mistakes made, but against Jared Golden, they put him in tattoos, didn't work. They attempted the same thing in upstate New York on the rap stuff, completely fell flat. Really sort of a silly argument made against Delgado. They attempted it in Kansas 3 against Sharice Davids. It fell flat. She had a lead throughout. Time and time again, their sort of strategy, again, all over the place, throw anything against the wall, but none of it really worked. And for us, we saw largely the same races competitive throughout. I mean, the notion that this was like, I know it's been talked about sort of as a big, huge map, and certainly we were competitive in a lot of places, and there were some surprises last night. But overall, we were competing in those same districts from April until election. I mean, there was not a lot of change. And for me, our mission, frankly, was to see these races through. We were on TV in Kansas 3 to the end. We were on TV in Minnesota 3 in the final weeks, in Minnesota 2, in Iowa 1, in Iowa 3, all places that I think, you know, either lean Dem or toss up, but we knew we hadn't won a bunch of these places, and some of them ever. Illinois 6, we were on TV till the end. Illinois 14. And so for me, it was a broad map, but at the same time, we spent $113 million between us and our partner organization, Patriot Majority. We invested in dozens of races, but the real investments, the heavy investments, over $1 million in 30 plus races. And I think over $2 million or thereabouts in half of those. So 15 or 16 races we were invested fully. And then obviously all the partner spend as well, which ended up being over $200 million on the progressive side. The Republicans never saw that coming.
So Charlie, I want to talk about a couple of races specifically. that are very interesting to me as we lift up to talk about some of the macro trends that analysts and political scientists and people in the political profession will be looking at from this election. And that's obviously the division that is emerging between the suburbs and the exurbs and rural parts of America. And we saw some of that in the map last night. But exemplifying the Democratic success in the suburbs across the country, you had everywhere from Detroit to Philly to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to Dallas, to Houston, to Los Angeles, you name it, right? Denver. What I'm really interested in is in Texas, you had these two races in the 32nd District and the 7th District where these Republican incumbents, John Culberson in the Houston area and Pete Sessions in the Dallas area, these are guys who had not faced a tough election in a very, very long time, if ever. And they both went down last night. And I'm wondering what effect Beto O'Rourke's candidacy had in that state and whether or not you think they could have won without him on the ticket.
So I think certainly the Beto campaign, I mean, you saw what happened in Harris County, huge turnout across the board in Houston. Same thing in Dallas. I think Beto had an impact on those races. I think those races would have been competitive without a competitive Senate race. And I think we could have picked up both of them anyway. Colin Allred, for example, in Texas 32, Colin Allred ran a spectacular campaign.
Yeah, you told me you thought, when we talked earlier, you told me you thought he might be the best recruit of the entire cycle.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, he's been successful. Everything he touches is gold. And so I think that from his career as a professional football player, his work as an attorney, I mean, again, he has a record of success in the community. He won a very contested primary. And then he ran a really tough runoff. So that obviously he was sort of battle hardened for the general election. Sessions didn't take it seriously. These districts too, in both Texas 32 and Texas 7, they've changed so much under the incumbent's feet. It's much more diverse in both of them. You sort of saw from afar. I mean, again, we're not on the ground there, but we saw, you read about it, you hear about it. The groundswell of support around Collins' campaign and this sort of broader Democratic primary that moved into the general was extraordinary. And the contrast couldn't have been more clear. You know, you have a guy that's sort of been in Washington 20 plus years, taking millions, tens of millions in special interest money. This is a guy that's voted against middle class families time and again. Opposite Colin Allred, who's saying, look, I'm here to support you. I'm here to work hard for the middle class. Again, the district has changed. The same thing in Houston. You know, Harris County is a place that is now, I think, you know, obviously was created for George H.W. Bush in the 70s. It's now 50% plus non-white.
The most amazing statistic from Harris County is Barack Obama carried Harris County by fewer than 600 votes against Mitt Romney in 2012.
Yeah.
And Beto O'Rourke beat Ted Cruz there last night by nearly 200,000 votes.
Okay, so but looking back at the data, again, Beto helped and the surge was big and that obviously pushed us over probably. But polling last fall, Culberson to me is sort of like the John Micah or Garrett from the 2016 cycle or Lee Terry from the 14th cycle. Totally caught flat-footed, not prepared to run a modern campaign, as you said. At the same time, we saw data, again, last fall that showed Culberson underwater, fave on fave, and down to a generic Democrat by as many as 10 points. Now, that was at a time in November right after the Northam race when the generic really had grown. We probably had a plus 10 or 12 at that point nationally. But still, for a generic Democrat to be ahead of Culberson, Culberson's name ID was only in the, I think, 50s. So for an incumbent, again, in a big metro area who thinks he's well-known, well-liked, he was neither. He was really doomed early on. It got better for him probably in September or early October when things sort of polarized to a degree. But at the end of the day, I think, again, look, both candidates, and frankly, we might win Texas 23. That might go to a runoff.
Well, I think they're going to wind up having a recount there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, excuse me, that's a recount. And we might end up getting three out of Texas.
So I want to talk more about the macro trends I was alluding to a minute ago. Obviously, people are going to look at the results on the Senate side as sharply divergent from the results on the House side, and they're going to talk about the distinctions between red America and blue America, but really just within the House map, we can also look at some of those same distinctions. What you've begun to see over the past decade or so is an acceleration of many of these affluent, white-collar, college-educated suburbanites moving from the Republican Party, where they had a home for generations, towards the Democratic Party, and vice versa. with blue collar, middle class and working class voters beginning to move from the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, the class inversion, as Ron Brownstein likes to say. And obviously, Republicans have to be deeply concerned about this as it relates to the suburbs. And I've talked to many of them about that. I'm curious from your perspective, the level of concern that Democrats have about these exurban and rural areas that were once strongholds that Republicans have begun to sort of put the clamps down.
So I start from early on this cycle, I always believed that we had an opportunity in these non-college or sort of working class districts. A lot of them in my mind have Democratic DNA. It's one of the reasons we've done two cycles now working with the sort of the steelworkers and others in legally permissible ways. They started through U.S. Works, a long form research program years ago to better understand sort of some of the challenges facing Democrats broadly and some of these non-college districts, more rural and exurban districts. And so we obviously in 2016, we did a lot of work on that. We started in 2017, laid out that platform, made everything public, our research platform and program. I've always believed that we can be competitive in these places. We've clearly had challenges for cultural, economic reasons over the last couple of cycles. But when you make an economic case to these voters, things that they care about, again, the kitchen table stuff, you can have success. Many of these places have Democratic DNA. Iowa won, which went for Trump in 2016, was won by Obama with over 58% of the vote. We had success. Abby Finkenauer, labor background, she did a terrific job. Sidney Axne in Iowa 3, which is southwestern Iowa from Des Moines to Omaha, we won that district as well. There are a number of places we were competitive last night that Trump did well in 2016, upstate New York, Maine too. We've talked about a lot of these places. I think we'll continue to be competitive. We just need to make the economic case. I will double down on these districts because I believe for us to have a national party, a party of success, we need to be competitive everywhere and make the economic appeal. Because again, when we're at our best, we're making that appeal. And I think, you know, going forward, we're going to see and we're going to continue to be competitive in these places. I think we can be competitive in Minnesota 1, Minnesota 8, a lot of these places maybe that we came up slightly short last night. You know, we're going to have success over the long haul because we're making that case.
And the context in all of this is really important, right? Because if you look at an Iowa or an Ohio, states that Donald Trump won by, you know, relatively wide margins, historically speaking, in 2016, you can't see the sort of swing back that you saw in Iowa, for example, last night, just on the backs of suburban voters, right? You don't see the 3rd congressional district, which is anchored in the Des Moines suburbs, but to your point a minute ago, stretches well beyond. That seat doesn't flip just because suburban voters have moved away from the Republican Party. You have to have a Democrat there who is also appealing to those blue-collar, to those middle-class, non-college educated voters.
Right, and we had success in Minnesota 7 last night. Colin Peterson won re-election. We had success in the Nevada seats, which, you know, are in a lot of ways more working-class districts. Max Rose won last night in Staten Island and part of Brooklyn.
It's a big upset.
Yeah, it was huge. But we saw survey work, and Vote Vets, I applaud them, invested at the end. In a pretty significant way, and a lot of success in that district. And you saw the groundswell. If you saw any sort of social media work, these long lines for any sort of canvassing operation that they were running in Staten Island, I've never seen the grassroots support for a Democratic candidate in that place. He obviously, he's a really, really strong candidate. And then it's, you know, some of these central New York places. I think we have an opportunity to path back. I'm doubly and sort of super committed to these races and these districts. And we'll continue to be because, again, we need to have success in these places. The suburbs, it was great last night. I'll be honest, I was skeptical early on of our ability to compete in places where we tried time and time again. Barbara Comstock, Paulson, Kaufman, you name it. A lot of these places we tried hard and just had come up short. But early on, our work said if we make an economic case in the Republican tax plan, we can be successful. And we were. And we had great candidates that obviously were making a strong case.
And not just successful in some of those districts you mentioned, but those were blowouts. I mean, some of those suburban districts where Democrats could not get over the top, suddenly in the first election in the era of Trump, you guys don't just win those districts, you win them by very healthy margins.
Yes.
As you watched the NRCC dump $5 million into Barbara Comstock's race, even as it was clear to basically everyone with a pulse that she was not going to be able to win re-election, what are you thinking to yourself?
Silliness. What a waste of money. We saw Wexton had 16 points in July. We pulled there every week to make sure because we ended up canceling our television time. Now, there was proper air cover down the stretch. The committee might have been up from what I remember. Other groups came in. So we actually had, we didn't pull out of almost anywhere. We were in New Hampshire 1 at the end. We were in Minnesota 3 the last couple of weeks. We were in Michigan 8 down the stretch.
Because you could afford to be.
Well, we could afford to be, but we've never won a bunch of these places. We'd never won Virginia We never won Northern Virginia. We didn't beat Comstock before, Virginia 10. But what we saw was that we were consistently had double digits. They just kept spending money. You hear it on WTOP. You see it on TV. It was a giant waste of money. They did it actually a couple of places. And I have no idea why. Colorado 6 is another place. Now, we'd never beaten Kauffman, so we actually continued to invest there. We were on TV the last couple of weeks. We had digital. We were doing mail.
But again, he was way down.
He was way down. But we outspent him. I think it was like 7,000 or 8,000 GRPs the last 3 weeks. A couple million dollars on TV. We outspent him everywhere. We outspent them in Texas 32 with Allred. Significantly down the stretch, 1,500 GRPs the last 3 weeks. 1.8 on TV, something like that. But almost everywhere. 10, 12, 15 districts the last 3 weeks. Again, they didn't anticipate it. The message strategy and the discipline and then the partnerships coming together. Dozen or so groups, regular conference calls. I give a ton of credit to everybody because everybody works so well together and the result is there. We raised and spent record amounts here at House Majority PAC. We had 400,000 unique contributions, $113 million approximately between us and our C4 partner. But the partnership and leveraging the sort of resources in a strategic way among the IE progressive partners, Independence USA, folks in the environmental community, labor, Emily's List, et cetera, was exceptional. Over $200 million this cycle. And I think we really surprised the other side.
They're not used to being outspent.
They're not used to being outspent. And we laid in wait until Labor Day. You sort of picture that, what is it, in Braveheart or whatever, hold. And then boom, come Labor Day, the last 9 weeks, we let them have it. We outspent the other side in 90% of the districts, the competitive districts, the last 9 weeks.
Does that make you William Wallace?
The pundits can talk about that. But what I will say is, no, but we put together, I think, a really, really thoughtful plan about how to organize and fill the gaps, bring everybody together on a common strategy, message, discipline, consistency. Nobody expected it to come. We did it. Again, candidates are raising record amounts of money. They're telling their story. They're doing a great job. But to provide the air cover necessary to be successful.
So, Charlie, I want to close by talking about where the Democratic Party goes from here. It's striking. There were a lot of parallels that people made between the 2010 election and the 2018 election with the incumbent president's party facing a backlash from the grassroots of the other party. And I think some of that was probably overdone, overplayed. The one thing that is striking to me is thinking about how a lot of the candidates on the Republican side in 2010 were also trying not to run as these fierce partisans, but framing themselves as more independent-minded, and they wanted to push back on the Republican establishment, and they didn't trust either party in Washington. And then a lot of those folks, once they came to Congress, they turned into fierce partisans. What level of concern should Democrats have that once these folks come to D.C. and they are in this environment, in the Trump-driven news cycle where everything is taken up to, you know, a level 10 every single day, that they will get sucked into that vortex and that they will not be able to sort of stay true to the messaging that was so successful for them during the campaigns and establishing those independent brands?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think these people had real records of success before running for Congress. I said before, again, this is the most credentialed group of recruits in a generation, certainly since 2006, but goes much further back than that. The parallel to 2010, that was a wave where I think there actually are pretty significant differences, because I think the recruits here, they decide they want to run for Congress and really make a strong case and a change and put a check on what's happening with the administration, what's happening in Washington, really sort of reset what Congress is doing.
So all eyes will be on this new Democratic majority in the coming weeks as they elect their leaders. You had several dozen Democratic candidates across the country saying that they would not support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker. And obviously now this is where the going gets tough and they have to put their money where their mouth is. What do you expect to happen? Do you think Nancy Pelosi will be the leader of the Democratic caucus?
Yes, I do.
You do.
Nancy Pelosi was a terrific speaker. She's going to be a terrific speaker again. And she has done extraordinary work for the American public. There's no question about that.
But is there a backlash for candidates? I mean, you had the Democratic winner in the Virginia 7th Congressional District who ran an ad about how she would not vote for Pelosi. So what do some of these Democrats do? How do they get away with voting for her?
At the end of the day, look, I know that Nancy Pelosi did a great job as speaker. She'll do a great job going forward. She's committed to focused on lifting up the middle class. Individuals across this country, providing economic opportunity, education, infrastructure investments in the right, doing it the right way. I can't speak to what these individual candidates will do, but I can tell you, I think she'll be speaker going forward.
That's good enough for me. Charlie, Kelly, thank you so much. Congratulations on a nice election night for you and your party.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this quick break. So Corey, let's jump right in here. Obviously, a lot to talk about with what happened in the House last night, and we're still not entirely clear on the total number of net seats gained by the Democratic Party. But I'm interested from your perspective in the surprises. First, what was the most pleasant surprise for you last night? What was the race that you were in your heart of hearts already counting out for Republicans that they wound up winning? What was the one that really surprised you in that way?
Well, one, thanks for having me today.
Oh, it is a pleasure.
You know, when I look at last night, I have real mixed emotions. You know, obviously, I'm disappointed that we lost control of the House, but I think the party exceeded a lot of expectations. In the Senate, we gained at least three seats. You know, a job well done to Stephen Law, one of my good friends, and his team at SLF. And in the governor's races, I think we exceeded expectations. All the pundits said we were going to lose Florida, we were going to lose Ohio. And even in the House, I think we exceeded expectations. Right, the last time we did this, the first midterm of an incumbent president in 2010, we picked up 63 seats. President Obama, the Democrats lost 63 seats. So holding it to 35, I think, exceeds expectations in everything we were reading over the weekend and puts us in a very strong position to retake the House in 2 years. Running CLF, you know, my job is to do the best I can do with what I can control, and that is raise as much money as possible. And thanks to Paul Ryan, thanks to Kevin McCarthy, you know, CLF was able to raise and spend $160 million, which was a big deal because one of the tactical challenges we faced was the green wave. And we'll talk about it, I'm sure, but the green wave was real. And thanks to raising that amount of money, we were able to compete in 52 races across the country. In 45 of those 52, we were outspent. A couple that stand out to me, I think Andy Barr's race in Kentucky was one of the most hotly contested races in the whole country. That was the first race we went on TV in July. After the primary, our first survey had Amy McGrath's image at 53-14, and she was leading by 13 points on the ballot. And because of our fundraising, we were able to go in July, be on TV, stay up on TV. Another thing that we did in Kentucky and around the country is that we ran a national field program that we opened actually 40 offices in 40 districts around the country, knocked on 35 million doors. And I think that made a big deal in Kentucky. You know, the last 2 weeks, we were honed in specifically on Franklin and Scott County, turning out Republican voters. And I think that had a big deal and had a lot to do with Andy Barr's victory. I think Andy Barr ran a great race, but I think the CLF field program really helped him get across the finish line.
And I was in Kentucky 6 over the weekend, as you know, visiting that field office and talking with Amy McGrath, a Democratic challenger. That was a race that I think you guys felt pretty good about. What was a race that you didn't feel good about that you wound up winning last night and you were pleasantly surprised by?
Well, I'm really surprised and I'm really happy, right, that we won Brian Fitzpatrick's race in Pennsylvania. That was a tough district. That's a Hillary Clinton district. He ran against a self-funder. You know, he was outspent by almost $4 million. He ran a great campaign focused on local issues, you know, from the water well to the opioid epidemic. And, you know, we were proud to help him. You know, we spent significant resources. That was a hard-fought victory. You know, but in this environment, any race that you win is an accomplishment. You know, we were proud to play a big role in the two seats we picked up in Minnesota. Pete Stauber, we've been knocking on doors for about 8 months there. We knocked on almost 500,000 doors. We were the biggest spender in that race. Jim Hagedorn, we spent significant resources on his race. And then we won tough fought races across the country. Mimi Walters ran a great campaign, won a very tough race in a tough district. She was outspent by almost $3 million. We were very proud to play a role there. Young Kim, which is one of our biggest expenditures in Orange County, it looks like she's ahead and looks like she'll win. I think she will be a future superstar of the party, the first Korean woman that Republicans will have ever elected to Congress. And we are proud to be involved in that race. So we had a lot of tough races that CLF played a big role in. And I think there's a case to be made that if it wasn't for CLF raising $160 million, being able to compete in 52 races, also helping spread Democrat money, across the country that we could have lost upwards of 50 seats last night.
So let's talk about some of the losses. You mentioned Minnesota, a couple of Republican pickups, but obviously also had a couple of Republican losses there. And I don't think those were a big surprise. You had a lot of surveys over the last couple of months showing that Eric Paulson in Minnesota's 3rd District was almost hopelessly behind in that race. So that probably wasn't a big surprise. But what was the most unpleasant surprise for you last night? What was a race where you felt really good about, but the Republican just couldn't get across the finish line?
Obviously, this is an incredibly tough environment, right? History said this is going to be a tough environment. Throw in 40-plus retirements and throw in the green wave with $100 million from Michael Bloomberg on top, and you're going to create a very tough map and a very tough environment. But candidates and campaigns matter.
And a lot.
A lot. And the tougher the year, the more it matters. You know, one person who I think ran a perfect campaign and lost by a nose is Carlos Cabello. Mm-hmm. I think Carlos Cabello ran a great race, worked hard, raised money, was in tune with the district, and he lost by a little bit over a point in a district that Hillary Clinton lost by 16.
So he won by 16.
Won by 16, that's right. So he ran 15 points ahead of her.
But it wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough, and that's very disappointing because I think he deserved to win. You know, on the other side, if we're being honest, there were a couple members of Congress who didn't raise enough money, who didn't start early enough, who I guess didn't work hard enough. You know, Steve Russell in Oklahoma, I think raised about $1 million for the cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, Dan Donovan raised almost no money after the primary. And those are races in the world of the green wave, you know, where Michael Bloomberg goes in and puts $2 million into Oklahoma at the end, where Dan Donovan's opponent, you know, outspent him about 10 to 1 on TV, that if you're not prepared, if you don't start early, if you don't raise money in the off year, if you don't put your campaign together in the off year, in this environment, you can get caught at the wire.
And those were two of the biggest upsets last night, races that were not really considered to be toss-ups but by any stretch. And then you also had, interestingly, look, I want to talk a little bit about the suburbs and the Trump effect, but before we lay too much blame on Trump, you did have some districts, including the Oklahoma district, for instance, and in New York 11, where Donald Trump is pretty popular. And I'm thinking specifically up in the Hudson Valley with Faso and with Tenney, two Republican incumbents who, despite Trump being pretty popular in their districts, they could not get across the finish line. And that speaks to your point about the importance of candidates and campaigns.
In this environment, if you get out raised 3-1, 4-1, if you wait to the last 4 months to try really hard, you are asking for trouble. In those two districts, President Trump is plus 10, plus 15. They were only close because of President Trump. You know, I give President Trump and the White House great credit. This environment that we had this week is dramatically better than it was in Labor Day. Around Labor Day, we were looking at a scenario where we could lose 50 or 60 seats, which history said very possible that we could. I think President Trump and the White House really led the charge, starting with the Kavanaugh process, you know, defending him, ensuring he gets to the Supreme Court to transform and improve the environment, right? So the environment as a whole, we limited losses in the House. Now the focus is going to shift to the Democratic Party, and I think they have a lot of obstacles that will shed light on. I think they learned next to nothing. I mean, Pelosi will be speaker again. Basically, every tough race in America, the Democrat campaigned against Pelosi and really against the Democratic Party. I think there's going to be a lot of new members of Congress who won yesterday. In a year, their constituents will be very surprised and very disappointed to learn they're actually Democrats, right? Because a lot of these candidates ran as kind of nonpartisan, bipartisan, you know, parents who were just going to come here and save the world, and they didn't know who Nancy Pelosi was, and they've never met her, and they certainly wouldn't vote for her. And I think a lot of their constituents are going to be very disappointed to see what they do when they get here.
Well, the rubber is going to meet the road, right? I think we've seen a lot of parallels between the 2010 cycle and the 2018 cycle. And listen, in 2010, it's easy to forget now, but a lot of these folks who were running under the Tea Party banner were doing so to distance themselves from the Republican Party. And they were talking about good government and being independent-minded. And then many of them became reflexively partisan not long after they arrived. And so will Democrats fall into that same trap? I spent the last weekend before the election swinging through the Rust Belt, through the industrial Midwest. And to your point, Corey, every Democratic nominee, those who won and those who lost, were hitting those same notes of, you know, look, we are not comfortable with the leftward march of the Democratic Party, and we're coming to Congress not to go after Trump, but to try and get government back on the rails. I think it's going to be a very fascinating period of time now as we watch how the Democratic Party resolves this internal conflict over how best to defeat Donald Trump, especially now that we've turned the page and it's officially the 2020 campaign.
And I predict what you're going to hear about now is endlessly about Donald Trump's tax returns, about impeaching Donald Trump. And as the progressive energy rises and rises running for president, look at Nebraska too, Don Bacon. At the beginning of the cycle, that was one of the top 10 races in the country. That was where we put our first CLF field office. We started knocking on doors February 1st of last year. We knocked on almost 1 million doors in that district. And Kara Eastman, the progressive champion, won the primary, too progressive for that district. And by the time we got to election, the Democrats had pulled all their money out of that race, and we had easily won that race. And that had started as a top 10 race. And I think you're going to see all these progressive candidates yelling and screaming, who can impeach the president the quickest, who can yell the loudest about his tax returns. You know, which one of these candidates is going to win Ohio? Is Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker have a chance to win Ohio? I would argue no.
Yeah, because I think the biggest lesson I take away from last night, if I'm a Democrat, is that you, in order to succeed, especially in middle America, you have to have candidates who fit the district or who fit the state.
No, or in order to proceed, in order to succeed, pretend to be a Republican.
Well, I don't know that it's to pretend to be a Republican, but look, I think that there's an interesting way to frame where the Democratic Party is today in terms of where it has been as much as where it is going, because you do hear some of these Democrats trying to channel the Dick Gephardt, Dave Obie style, old Rust Belt, Blue Dog, fiscal conservatism that Democrats were once known for in that part of the country. And what's really interesting, I'm from Michigan's 8th District. We've talked about that race a little bit, Corey. And Mike Bishop, the incumbent, this was sort of a classic case of a Republican incumbent who's steady but unspectacular, who probably didn't raise enough money, who probably didn't campaign quite hard enough, do enough to hold off a Democratic challenge. But in almost any other cycle, he wouldn't have to, right? That's not a seat that should be competitive on paper for the Republicans. And so he sort of lacked the muscle memory, and he wound up losing to one of the best Democratic recruits of the cycle, Alyssa Slotkin.
Look, I think that's fair, but also you have to remember, so history was against us, 40-plus retirements was against us, and then tactically down the stretch, the green wave really was against us. You know, in every race, we were outspent. 45 out of 52 of the races CLF participated in, we were outspent. On average, almost $2 million.
The candidates were outspent.
The Republicans versus the Democrats, all in, everybody.
Yes.
You know, and we, that has been the story of the cycle.
But the most dramatic break was between the candidates themselves, right? Because the outside groups are always going to come in with their money. But at the end of the day, and for the people who aren't, you know, political junkies, they may not realize that candidates themselves are always going to be able to purchase ad time at lower rates. And their money, therefore, goes a lot farther. So when you do have Republican incumbents being outraised across the board by Democratic challengers, that makes life difficult no matter how much money that CLF or any outside organization can pump in.
And the Democrats deserve credit. They did a great job with hard dollar, small dollar fundraising that helped their candidates get on TV early. Start earlier than ever before, be aggressive. One of the reasons why we had to go on TV in July against Amy McGrath in Kentucky, she raised $8.5 million. She's basically on TV since May. One of the reasons why CLF had to go on TV in the first week of August in Cincinnati for Steve Chabot, he was running against a first-time opponent. We had that race tied. His opponent basically had unlimited money and was going to be on TV any day. That there was a number of these races that I think CLF played a big role in August. That if we didn't win August in these races, it wouldn't matter who was going to win October, because the Democrats had records amount of money, first-time candidates, and they did a good job recruiting some good stories and good candidates. And in this environment, if you get to create this image of a nonpartisan, bipartisan mom or dad,
political outsider,
three cute little kids, and you're just going to save the world, and oh, P.S., before you decided to come save the world, you spent a couple of years in the Middle East blowing up terrorists, you're going to win.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter where you're running, against who you're running.
Blowing up terrorists is always a plus.
It's always a plus. That is bipartisan.
Oh, yeah. Well, I should hope so. You know, what's interesting, obviously, you look at the diverging Senate results and House results last night, and we talk about these two Americas. But really, you can also see it within just the House, right? Obviously, Republicans, not just in the age of Trump, over the past 6 to 8 years, Republicans have really strengthened their standing in exurban and in rural areas of the country, whereas Democrats have continued to make pretty steady gains in suburban areas. And I want to talk about what the implications are for both parties moving forward. But before I do, I think a segue into that is you and I talked a little bit about the special elections in this cycle. And I think the most notable one was in Georgia's 6th congressional district in 2017, when Republicans had to spend tons of money to hold that seat in the Atlanta suburbs, a seat that Donald Trump had carried by 23 points because of the symbolic value, right? And so on the one hand, you guys did hold that seat by a small margin, but you told me afterwards, you know, we won the battle, but we may have lost the war.
But George, that special election seems like it was 20 years ago.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, there was 9 special elections in the House this cycle, and we won 8 out of 9. CLF spent almost $25 million in all these special elections. And the first big one was Georgia 6. We learned a couple lessons in Georgia 6. Number one, it was astronomical how much John Ossoff raised. I mean, John Ossoff basically was just a kid who lived in his parents' basement, who raised $30 million on the internet. And I remember that one of the moments I always remember is the first report that came out, and I believe he had raised $8.5 million. And I looked that on Twitter. I said, this has to be a typo. John Ossoff, sitting in his underwear in his parents' basement, raised $8.5 million in a month. So, but that taught us the green wave is coming. And that was before Michael Bloomberg decided to do $100 million, you know, which is kind of extra credit. So we had to learn we're going to get outspent in every race. We have to do things differently to win. That if it's just the old model, which is I'm just going to have one more TV ad than you on every show, we might not win a single race this cycle. And in that race, all the parties, all the outside groups worked so well together and we won. But we did such a good job attacking, defining, and beating John Ossoff. Maybe we did too good of a job, right? Because it was all about tying him to Pelosi. San Francisco money, San Francisco liberal values. We produced really good ads that we shot in San Francisco. The city of San Francisco threatened to sue us. It was, you know, it was a lot of fun behind the scenes. But it basically provided a roadmap to a lot of candidates. How to survive. Look at John Ossoff. Study John Ossoff and just do the opposite. Connor Lamb, who's a much better candidate than John Ossoff, and you could tell that he had studied John Ossoff very closely.
And this is in the special election in Pennsylvania.
And decided just do the opposite. You know, so we won the battle, may have hurt us in the war. It's nobody's fault. You know, at the time, we had to win that race.
And Nancy Pelosi is used to being the boogeyman or boogeywoman, as it were, for the Republican Party. But look, I think Democrats and Republicans have been pretty broadly in agreement when you have these conversations, at least privately with them over the past year, that if Nancy Pelosi had stepped down or had announced declaratively that she would not be the Speaker of the House, then you guys probably lose another 10 or 12 seats. If Republicans were robbed of that political tool to use against Democrats, then you're probably looking at an even worse night last night.
Well, Nancy Pelosi is the most unpopular, polarizing politician in American politics, period. End of discussion. I think every Republican hopes she
never... More so than Trump?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think every Republican...
Want to crunch the numbers on this?
I think every Republican hopes she never retires. And it's clear that Democrats learned very, very little as she's about to become Speaker again. And I think we're all excited to have her be Speaker again and remind the American people what that means. That means raising your taxes, weak on border, San Francisco liberal values. And we'll see all these candidates who won, who said they don't know who she is, they've never met her, would never take a picture with her, certainly not take any money from her. We'll see who they vote for. And I predict a lot of them will follow her every step of the way. And that'll be a big problem for them in 2 years. That'll be one of the reasons we take back the House in 2 years.
So let's talk about these suburbs. Obviously, across the map last night, nationwide, from Detroit to Chicago to Philly to New York to Washington to Houston to Oklahoma City, Richmond, Virginia, you name it, Los Angeles. You've got Republicans just hemorrhaging support in the suburbs. And I want you to talk about, Corey, what you saw last night specific to that, but then also just extrapolate out a little bit on where you see that trend taking the party and what adjustments need to be made in order to prevent long-term damage to the party.
Well, almost every race is winnable. There's very few races that are not winnable. And I think candidates and campaigns really, really matter. Look at a couple of the winners from last night. Mimi Walters ran a tremendous campaign focused on what she's accomplished for her constituents, from legislation to get rid of sex trafficking, to going home every weekend and selling tax reform. And that's a very tough district, a very affluent, educated district. She got outspent by close to $3 million. All the pundits wrote her off, said she had no chance to win. She won. Brian Fitzpatrick, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, district that Hillary Clinton won. He ran against a self-funder, got outspent by millions of dollars, did a great job, focused on local issues, put a diverse coalition together, and he won by a comfortable margin. So candidates and campaigns matter. In some races, there's other factors that play in. Sometimes the top of the ticket, in Illinois certainly didn't help Peter Roskam, certainly didn't help Randy Holcrin. So every race is different. Yes, we struggled in districts that Hillary Clinton won 2 years ago. But if we have good candidates who run strong campaigns, we have every opportunity to win almost all those seats back in 2 years.
And, you also had in some suburban areas a lot of investment in candidates and in campaigns who, frankly, were not going to be competitive. It was clear that Barbara Comstock, for instance, was not going to win in Virginia's 10th district in the suburbs, exurbs of Washington, D.C. Mike Kaufman in Colorado, the same story. Peter Roskam outside of Chicago. And yet the party committee itself, which obviously you are not a part of that, but the party committee continued to dump money into these races. What is the rationale behind that strategically from where you're sitting?
Well, this was a very tough environment, and I think everybody did a good job. I think everybody worked well together. And by any measure, we defied expectations yesterday, right? Reading the pundits, we were supposed to lose 50, 60 seats in 2010. It was 63 seats the Democrats lost. This is a tough environment, and politics is a tough game. And against the green wave with 40 retirements, there's just not enough money for everyone. So tough decisions had to be made. But moving to the future, if we recruit strong candidates in these suburban districts, we absolutely can win. And remember, one of the reasons to be optimistic about the future of the party is that on issues, I believe the voter, the American people, agrees with us, whether it's tax reform, middle-class tax cut, immigration. And that's a big problem that the Democrats are going to struggle with under Pelosi's leadership. On the issues, we can and we will win.
As you look at Donald Trump and his impact on this election, he went from talking about a red wave to talking about, I am on the ballot. And it had been made clear to him from people in the White House, look, you've got some complacency in the Republican base. We cannot afford to have these people thinking that November is going to be all sunshine and roses for us. What was the impact on the aggregate that you saw Trump playing in this race? Obviously, he hurt in some districts. He helped in probably fewer districts. But on the whole, what do you make of how voters responded to Republicans in some of these districts specifically because of their feelings about the president?
Well, in around Labor Day, if you read all the pundits, they said, blue wave, 50, 60 seats. We're going to lose the Senate. And it was a tough environment. And President Trump and the White House led the charge. They did maybe the hardest thing in American politics to excite and unite the Republican base, move us all forward in the right direction. And as a result, in any measure, the party defied expectations yesterday. Do you always want to do better? Of course you want to do better. But we picked up at least three seats in the Senate, won a bunch of hotly contested big governor's races that no one gave us a chance to. And I just remember reading this weekend what all the pundits were saying about the House. They were talking 40, 50 seats. And we're going to be somewhere in the mid-30s. So compared to 2010, we did way better. Why is that? President Trump excited and united the base.
Well, and in fairness, obviously, Republicans also in 2010 had structural advantages due to gerrymandering that Democrats did not have in a cycle like this.
Well, this time we surely did not have structural advantages.
Well, the interesting thing, and that's, I think, in part because of this change between the suburban and the rural and the exurban populations. I was joking with a friend last night saying it's almost like the Republican maps drawn 15 years ago have come back to bite them, right? Because Republicans wanted to try and have as many of these suburban-based districts as possible, when in fact, Republicans circa 2018 would probably be in much better shape running under the maps that existed in the 1980s and 1990s. Corey, a last question for you here, and we're really appreciative of your time. I'm curious, nobody ever nails all of this stuff. Nobody gets everything right. You guys work slavish hours on both sides trying to promote your parties, promote your candidates. What is the one thing, as you were watching the returns come in last night, what is the one tactical decision made that you kicked yourself for and thought, man, you know what? I really wish, knowing what I'm seeing now, I really wish I would have done this differently.
Well, I'm a big horse racing fan. And when you're at the racetrack handicapping, after the race, it's always very easy.
Yes.
So, I should have been on the 7 horse. Of course he was going to win. So when you know who won and lost, obviously people who lost, you wish you spent less money on. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I'm proud of the effort that CLF did, you know, raising $160 million, being able to compete in 52 races. I think if it wasn't for CLF, we could have lost 50 seats last night. And there's one other thing I really wish we could have done. I wish we could have figured out a way to have convinced Michael Bloomberg to give us the $100 million and not the Democrats. That really would have helped win a whole bunch of seats.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with that as you proceed into your future endeavors and move into the 2020 cycle, which begins today. Corey Bliss, the executive director of the Congressional Leadership Fund, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
That's it, and that's all for this election season and for this week's episode of Off Message. Did you buy what Corey Bliss and Charlie Kelly were selling? What do you make of the Democratic takeover of the House and of Republicans' expansion of their Senate majority? As always, I look forward to your feedback at my email address, talberta@politico.com. Thanks as always to my awesome producer, Zach Stanton, and our great executive producer, Dave Shaw. If you like this podcast, and heck, even if you don't like this podcast, please leave us a review on Apple or Stitcher or wherever you're listening. It helps us find new listeners for the show. We here at Off Message are going to take a little bit of a post-election breather, but we'll be back soon with new and exciting episodes of your favorite political podcast, Off Message. Hope to see you then.